When I started planning this project to meet to discuss transitions in the welfare state, I never imagined we'd be doing it in the midst of a global economic crisis. I think none of us saw this coming. The events of recent months have made all too clear, though, that markets can bring great risks and that governments are the primary instrument for addressing those risks in order to create economic and social stability and well-being. Therefore, the welfare state, a broad term, but we'll discuss it a little bit, is a truly important institution. Oh, that's still me. And it is, I think of it as being comprised of policies and institutional arrangements through which countries manage their economic and social welfare interests. Welfare states are dynamic, continually readjusting to economic and social changes and to political pressures. And today, of course, they face the extraordinary challenge of responding to market turmoil and its aftermath. Now, we know welfare states come in many varieties, vanilla, strawberry, chocolate, ranging from the highly elaborated Nordic welfare states to the very minimalist Anglo-Saxon welfare states, most minimalist of all, the U.S. Differences in welfare state policies and their organizational arrangements have important consequences for the capacity of countries to address poverty and inequality. And this is a critical function for all democratic societies. In the more affluent democratic states, these differences are less a matter of resource availability than of how countries negotiate tough political choices. One way to think about these political choices is that they affect the balance between a market-based system of distribution, which as a byproduct produces inequality, and a welfare-based system of distribution, which through democratic processes seeks greater equality and fairness. Now, this is not to say that there's necessarily an absolute trade-off between these two alternative systems of distribution, and we'll hear from some of my Danish colleagues about the flexicurity state, which attempts to find an alternative to a trade-off. But I think it is, at least it's something to consider, that social protection and robust markets need not be in conflict. One of the fundamental choices, though, that welfare states make is how they organize for work. And I use the term organizing for work very purposefully. First, organizing for work occurs through the adoption of public policies directed at bringing marginalized populations into the market economy as workers. And today we're going to look closely at some of the choices countries have made to adopt policies variously named workfare, welfare to work, work activation. This particular type of policy strategy is one that targets the poor and disadvantaged, who are seen as living at the margins of the market economy. Now, living at the margins may mean they're in unstable jobs, work for low pay, work outside the formal economy, or simply have no paid work at all. What's problematic about this for society is that economic marginalization is closely associated with poverty and inequality. The second meaning I would suggest is important in organizing for work occurs through the practices of organizations where policy implementation takes place. These organizations, public, nonprofit, even for-profit, find themselves being organized to do this work. As today's speakers will discuss, it's a mistake to think about policy strategies without attending to the organizational practices through which they're realized. It's where the action is. So we're going to examine the street-level organizations that bring policy to people as pivotal players in managing work and managing welfare state transitions. Now, to set the stage for the discussion to come, I want to briefly review some data that illustrate how welfare states vary in their capacity to address poverty and inequality, and then set the stage with a very short tour of workfare history. But first, let's take a look at the relationship between market systems and inequality, just to paint a very quick picture. I'm going to put a lot of charts and data up here, but they will all be available later as handouts for those of you who really want to get into the numbers. In all advanced market democracies, markets produce inequality. This chart, which I grant you is hard to read, shows that market inequality, it may be highest in the US and the UK, but Sweden and other countries aren't far behind. Market inequality is substantial in a variety of countries. The issue is what countries do about it. And here, there's a big difference. And we see at the top end high-level government expenditures and how they relate to inequality. And briefly, the highest expenditures as a percent of GDP are associated with the least inequality. So Denmark and Sweden show the highest expenditures and the least inequality, and, well, you know who's at the bottom. And if you don't, you will very soon, because this is going to be a theme. Now, these differences, I think, become more starkly obvious if we look strictly at child poverty. And this chart shows observed poverty, which means poverty after government tax transfers have taken place, versus market poverty before government intervention. And this gets very interesting because we see that left to the market alone, child poverty rate in the UK is over 34%. But after state intervention, the rate is 19%. In Finland, the market child poverty rate is 18.5%. And after government intervention, less than 3%. In Australia, market child poverty 28%. After intervention, 16%. And you waiting for it? In the US, market child poverty rate of 26%, and government intervention reduces 26% to 22%. Currently in the US, poverty and inequality are not only among the highest levels compared to peer countries, pre and post transfer, but inequality has been growing markedly since the 1980s, well before the Great Recession hit. Between 1979 and 2003, the poorest fifth of the population gained only 4% in income. The top fifth gained 54%. The top 1% gained 129%. Where would you like to be? A more sophisticated way to measure this uses the Gini Index. Again, it shows a widening gap between the rich and everyone else. And again, this chart as well shows with families how there is a growing gap between rich and poor, and suggests that U.S. policies and government efforts do something to mediate the market, but not nearly enough. We have a poverty rate in the U.S. that is now about, well, now we don't know, but last measured was about 12.5%. And you see that, in fact, it has remained relatively high over a considerable period of time. More worrisome is an upward trend in deep poverty. Deep poverty meaning people living at less than half the poverty line. And this began to climb around in the year 2000. And this, of course, is pre-market collapse. I review this quick picture of the data to indicate that the choices countries make in balancing between market-based and welfare-based systems really matter, and that we face a problem of quite serious scope with respect to addressing poverty and inequality. If there's good news in these data, it is that governments can do something about poverty and inequality. It's not a matter of whether, it's a matter of whether they will. And that, of course, is a very tough problem. One of the major choices that we made in the last 20 years was to partly seek to address poverty and inequality by changing the way we organize for work. Work activation, welfare to work, was ostensibly aimed at bringing marginalized groups into the market as workers and through their work enable them to advance and improve poverty and inequality. A short history begins in the U.S., which has, since the New Deal of the 1930s, has always had an uneasy coexistence between market-based demands that people work and welfare-based possibilities for a basic social safety net and income support. This began to change in significant ways in the 1980s during the Reagan administration. The Reagan administration and its allies advanced a political strategy to reduce the size of government, especially social spending, sometimes called starve the beast, take the money away and then make the cuts happen. This was combined with efforts to make changes in welfare policy that, in effect, made the working poor ineligible for welfare and began to ratchet up work requirements and work demonstrations. This reached perhaps its apotheosis, familiar picture, when President Clinton signed into law a new welfare law that ended 60-year entitlement to a basic social safety net for poor families and made benefits entirely conditional on work. I have followed this workfare strategy in my research from Riverside, California, to the south side of Chicago, from Stockholm, Sweden, to Sydney, Australia. In the last 20 years, this has truly been a policy and a strategy that has circled the world. But what does it mean? It is more complex, a strategy with more permutations than we often appreciate. The same ostensible strategy may operate differently in different countries, in different environments, and in different organizations. How does it work in practice? One possibility, the happy, productive worker. Another possibility, not so much. I now turn to the problem of how we do this. Graham Allison famously observed, only 10% of the work of policymaking has been achieved when legislation is enacted. The remaining 90% occurs when organizations engage in its implementation. This means turning to what they do in the name of social policy. This has been affected in part by the introduction of a variety of managerial strategies that we will also discuss that organize the work of these implementing organizations in particular ways. As my colleague Rick Van Berkel has put it in his paper, workfare policies activate not only the disadvantaged individuals who are nominally policy subjects, but they also activate the organizations and their frontline workers, who are subject to the incentives and disincentives of these new managerial provisions. Like teachers who teach to the test, caseworkers who live and die by meeting the numbers are themselves transformed by the application of new managerial strategies, most dramatically performance measurement. The challenge for social research is to understand how policy and government interact to shape organizational practices and through them remake the welfare state. This affects our capacity to meet the challenges of addressing poverty and inequality and building a robust and just society. Organizations are at the cusp of this challenge, and this is what we are in store to learn today from an extraordinary set of speakers who are going to share their thoughts with us. So I welcome you here. Let's move on. Okay.
Good morning. My name is Jessica Dare. I'm a PhD student here at the University of Chicago School of Social Service Administration. And I'm here this morning to introduce to you all a man who everyone in this building knows at least something about. To a person, we have read or taught Michael Lipsky's Street Level Bureaucracy. So I thought I would begin with a personal anecdote of one such reading. I was intimidated by the prospect of graduate work at the University of Chicago. So several years ago, I decided to take a policy class to try it on for size and decide whether or not to apply. My class was assigned Street Level Bureaucracy by Michael Lipsky, and we learned how to apply the concept in Dr. Lipsky's book to real-life situations. I conducted my first mini-research project, and to my astonishment, I realized there was nothing intimidating about this work at all. Rather, I felt I had found the explanation for how people and organizations function. A mystery was solved, and I plunged headfirst into my academic career. I've tried on many a lens since that first class here at SSA with Evelyn Brodkin, but none has suited me so well as that of Dr. Lipsky, so I thank you, sir. You may all know that Professor Lipsky has made important contributions to the field of political science, but when I asked him last night at our dinner about his career and his personal experiences and his work, Professor Lipsky was careful to explain that his work in advocacy and social justice work, first at the Ford Foundation and now at Demos, had become increasingly meaningful to him at this stage in his career. He described the work at Demos, which is a search, if I may try and qualify it in one sentence, a search for the frames people use when thinking about government and democracy, and a reframing that encourages collective and inclusive perspectives. What you may not know about Professor Lipsky is that he is an organic farmer. In other words, he has tremendous patience. Thank you for exercising that patience here, and let me introduce Dr. Michael Lipsky.
I'm somewhat intimidated by the range of interests that people have and the centrality of the work of the frontline workers to the conference. And I'm truly, I will say something. I did prepare a little talk, but I'm quite uncertain as to whether I have a tremendous amount to contribute at this stage. I'll say a few words about the concept of street level bureaucracy, and then move to a couple of perspectives that I think over the years I've discovered are misunderstood, in my opinion, or vexing because of the oversimplification of what I think is involved. And of course, it's wonderful to be at the School of Social Service Administration to talk about these things, because there should be a home for studies of the implementation of welfare policy. So a couple of things about street-level bureaucracy it's mostly that people don't get the complexity when they take this concept and sort of insert it like a DVD into their computer minds and try to operate it as if it was self-explanatory and certainly as if it were simple. So at the heart of my conception of street-level bureaucracy is the dilemma of the individual in public services. And as I was saying to some colleagues last night, it's really wonderful that people engage in trying to work in public systems that help other people. And the fact that they do it under extremely adverse circumstances, where they themselves shoulder the responsibility for systems that are inadequate to a generous conception of human life, is remarkable. And yet they do it. And they do it in every field. So what we should keep in mind, I think, is that there are people who are at the core of this implementation process, going home to their families after a hard day and saying, now, what did I do today and how did I do it? And trying to carve out satisfaction within this corrupted system is really It's a development that is just unremarked too often, and I think that we should pay much more attention to. I put a lot of emphasis in the book on the distortions to a good policy that people apply because of the coping requirements that I described. But there are many more people who cope with these difficulties and come out at the other end feeling pretty good. So one of my wife's grandchildren is graduating from high school with a series of extraordinarily good teachers. And these are street-level bureaucrats, and yet they're not the they're not bad people, and they're not doing bad work. They're doing really wonderful work under difficult circumstances, and I think we don't appreciate that much. Another thing about street-level bureaucracy that I think, if you're interested in this, I guess I'm speaking to students here, that that you should bear in mind is that it is the fulcrum, as Evelyn said, that helps us bridge what happens to people in the welfare state and the broad conception of welfare policy understood in the most large, in the largest sense. There are very few other places where we look at what is happening on the ground and then what is happening in the societies at whole and trying to make something of it. And that's another aspect of the of welfare administration and of street-level bureaucracy that I would draw your attention to. Yeah, there's a little talk here. Evelyn said prepare a talk, so I prepared a talk. Whether or not I want to read this, I'm not sure at all. Let me just say that there are three things that we should be, that I, over the years I have felt are misunderstood about the concept, and I wish that we could do something about. So the first is, do street-level bureaucrats make policy? Unquote. So it's true that I said that in the book that the street-level bureaucrats make policy, that the actions of frontline workers become or add up to agency policy, that the actions effectively become the policies that they carry out. I did write all that. I conclude that people think that this is the essence of the concept because they only read the introduction. You know, they had a lot of other things to do, and that's what it says at the beginning of the preface, so I get it. It's about street-level bureaucrats make policy. But that is such a superficial view that we have to work hard, it seems, to correct that. And Evelyn anticipated some of the thoughts that I wanted to share beyond that. To say that street-level bureaucrats make policy does direct attention to the unsanctioned decisions that those who carry out government policy actually make. But, and I suppose I wanted to focus on that, and maybe it ought to be said, that if you are a close reader of the book, you know that the book is something of a historical artifact in the sense, as all books are, a product of their times. So I was writing in the 1970s about the 1960s, and in the 1960s there was a great deal of interest in the police work, in welfare work, in teaching, where African Americans were increasingly being incorporated into public systems. Very often the workforce that was responding to them were white, and there was a great deal of attention to, and properly so, as to what, how a white workforce was responding to an increasingly African American population. And so it is true that I was trying to understand what the nature of racial bias was, and if people said they weren't racist, and yet they seemed to have outcomes that seemed to have a racial component, resulted, how could that be? That was one of the things that the book was about. But it certainly isn't about street-level bureaucrats making policy in a crude sense. If you take the role of street-level bureaucrats in the new work and welfare regime, if work counselors were to truly be interested in helping people find jobs, their decisions about clients would be influenced by work opportunities in the welfare agency's catchment area and the availability of childcare and support for client training placements and opportunities. Those realities would be shaping the decisions that the so-called discretionary decisions that street-level bureaucrats would be inclined to make. Recently, we read in the New York Times a statement from welfare advocates that more people were being turned down for welfare benefits in New York City because of overly stringent or confusing requirements. Now, the advocates may be right, but it could be that the rules really are overly stringent or confusing, not that the workers were somehow bending the rules in an excessively stringent direction. In short, we have to look at the structures under which people are working, because that will shape the choices that people make. Professor Brodkin said this very well after I read an article that she'd written after I prepared most of these remarks, and she wrote in a recent article, "In effect, the quality of choices about help depend upon the helping resources to which street-level bureaucrats have access." Absolutely. Let me go on. Can street-level bureaucrats be managed? This is another astonishing observation that I've made. You know, where am I getting these astonishing observations? People send me articles to review, and I'm supposed to be a referee in referee journals, and I keep holding out the hope that I will be reading articles that really advance, to use an American athletic metaphor, move the ball down the field. But I keep being disappointed, I'm afraid. And one of the places where I'm disappointed is around the question, can street-level bureaucrats be managed? Now, of course, I contributed to this excessive simplification in the book because I put a lot of attention into the ways in which workers can resist management, the unwritten down rules that allow the workers to avoid strict managerial orders, so to speak. So I'm guilty of being complicit in this. But it's certainly obvious that managers can work with street-level bureaucrats to shape the range of choices that they make. And Evelyn alluded to this too, just in her remarks just now. Street-level bureaucrats' actions add up to the agency policy, but the production of that they make conform to managers' preferences within a certain range. I thought Bob Bain, in his book Leadership Counts, did a wonderful job in explaining how this happens and how it could happen. And I was privileged to be part of the managerial team as a consultant in Massachusetts when the ET Choices program was being developed. Bob Bain does a wonderful job as a kind of bureaucracy expert to show how an agency that was strictly focused on making sure that people were conforming to the accounting requirements, you know, did what was their income, what were their assets, all of that, how the workforce changed from that to being employment counselors. And of course, you had a governor, Michael Dukakis, who wanted this to happen and was riding this program to the Democratic presidential nomination. But the directors of the welfare department turned a indifferent staff that was no better or worse than any other welfare department into one that was finding people jobs and helping them and supporting them in their search for work. By establishing a clear mission and communicating that mission throughout the agency, by setting specific goals for individual workers and each work unit, Evelyn alluded to the importance of performance measures, and that's really what I'm talking about. The ET program essentially set up a series of rewards and radically clarified the expectations of workers, and the workers responded. I'm radically simplifying what went on in that program, but it's a very clear case of being able to manage workers by shaping the incentives. On the dark side of this observation, many people have talked about how conservative policymakers have used this technique by stealthily shaping the performance measures in order to get a different result, because they didn't want, these conservative policymakers didn't want to overtly rein in welfare policy. So they changed the incentives in the hopes that they could narrow the choices that the welfare workers had available to them. So that's the second gripe that I have about, I keep reading that that because street-level bureaucrats make policy, they can't be managed. And that really is obviously not the case. But so the challenge for us as administrators and as people who are thinking about policy administration is to find the right balance of incentives so that one can use the human qualities of the workers to achieve the public purposes that we strive for. You know, if we don't need workers acting with discretion, we ought to do a radical simplification of the policy in order to eliminate this discretionary judgment. So you're very familiar with routinization of work, de-skilling of work, turn people into computers or their equivalent so that you simply get the information. And increasingly, governments are using the information technology in order to reduce the human element in public services. And under some circumstances, that's right. I mean, I don't need a solicitous librarian to check me in or to, you know, lend me books. Let's routinize that as much as possible. And let's not be afraid of eliminating jobs if we can do a public policy better, because over time, public policies ought to be innovating and changing and inventing, accepting new technologies. The challenge for us, of course, is that we continue to believe that we are going to have, that we need people in these jobs. And we need them in the jobs beyond the fact that we just don't want to fire them or that they have a strong organization and so on. So up to now, I focused on the problem of street-level bureaucracy, a problem in the sense that street-level bureaucracy is understood primarily as creating difficulties for democratic accountability. But thinking about street-level bureaucracy only as an accountability problem for management diverts attention from the potential of street-level bureaucracies for achieving better results. That's really what I was driving at when I said, well, what is the human element that we need? We have to remember that it's no accident that street-level bureaucrats exercise great discretion in their work. For some kinds of work, it's essential that decisions are made fully in response to the presenting problem with wisdom and compassion. This is the case whatever the resources available to the workers. Now, those of you who are intimately involved with welfare policy may not recognize that this remains a central element, and that's a problem that I'm not going to address right now. Nowhere is it more evident that we need people who are able to make good decisions as street-level bureaucrats, than in the field of child protective services. So let me just mention this for a minute, and that's something that at the school you're very interested in too, I'm sure. Child protective service workers represent the welfare state in the polar extreme of the state as a protector of vulnerable members of society. In turn, Child Protective Service workers, or CPS workers, are themselves vulnerable because of the fateful judgments that they must render. There's no decision more fraught with potential for errors of omission and commission than those concerning whether children should be removed from their homes and families. The intrusiveness of the state in the personal lives of families is nowhere more consequential or more poignantly evident. But who are the people who are making these decisions? Here is how Harry Spence, the Commissioner of Social Services in Massachusetts, up until a few years ago, described who these people are. "We entrust the basic work of ensuring the safety of children to individual social workers, generally between the ages of 23 and 30, with an average tenure in the department of 1 year and 11 months, with 1 month of training. We ask them with only one set of eyes and ears to observe each of at least 18 families for a few hours each month, often in circumstances of considerable tension and even danger. We require that they then predict the future behavior of that family and make gut-wrenching, life-shaping decisions on the basis of those scant observations. They live with a constant knowledge that if they are wrong, a child may die, and they will be fired and publicly excoriated." Who wants to be that worker? And how do you become the Commissioner of Social Services? And do you create performance measures to have a better outcome, like fewer children dying? Well, no, you don't do that. You need to call upon you need to evoke the qualities of people that you brought into that agency in order to have better outcomes. For Harry Spence, the challenge was not to develop accountability mechanisms to secure compliance with agency objectives. Instead, he saw that he had to empower the DSS workers to make sound decisions, which he tried to do by doing a couple of things, and I can't do justice to all of it, but he developed a team-based approach to CPS visits so that individual workers never went on their own, but always in a team, totally changing the dynamic of the interaction with families. Because when there are two people in the room, there's the good cop and the bad cop, there's the older person and the younger person, there are people who can play off each other, and a sense of trust became evident. He improved their training radically, and he created accountability systems based on the medical model where you never were blamed if things went wrong, but instead were encouraged to bring problems to a group consultation where you could talk about the difficulties and become and get better and create group learning. In the new accountability system, he promised never to scapegoat workers when a child died in the care of the department. He said he would stand behind all of those workers so that they didn't have to fear this terrible thing and therefore make bad decisions on the basis of that kind of personal fear. Well, I could go on about Harry Spence and this work, but my general point is that we need to, and I hope we can find ways to resurrect the idea that these are people in these human services agencies who are trying to do a good job under difficult circumstances, and supporting them is a critical question which doesn't really get focused on in the bureaucracy and accountability paradigm. And this is the real shame of these developments. The work of street level bureaucracy as it's unfolded seems to me to be nestled within the question of how do we get better managerial results, understood in this narrow sense. And I think there are, particularly in places like teaching and child protective work, in regulation work, there's a great deal of area where cultivating the individual and improving their capacity is a better way to think about street-level practice. Thanks for your attention. I'd be delighted to have questions, because then I could think of something different to say. Any questions? Yes, ma'am.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for your talk.
Yeah.
I want to go back to the second or third point that you made about this idea of discretion and the movement either towards or for a more kind of eligibility compliance model. And I know that Evelyn has written about this as well in terms of not thinking of discretion as all good or all bad and complicating how we think about the use of bureaucratic discretion on the part of caseworkers. So I wanted to hear more about that and what your thinking is about the necessity in our current era of welfare reform to give workers more discretion versus less discretion as they implement policies and come into contact with more and more complicated stories of families' lives.
Yeah. I thank you for the question. I tried to address that, but perhaps not to your satisfaction, when I talked about the notion that discretion is always shaped by the opportunities available. And what I wanted to stress was that if you think that you're only thinking about street-level bureaucracy and discretion, you know, looking at it in a very narrow lens, you're not going to be looking at what the opportunities are for people. So you can give me all the discretion in the world, but if I don't have an ability to send you to some kind of training program, or if the jobs aren't available, or if you don't have a car but the job that you could be eligible for is not within your range of possibility, you can give me all the discretion in the world, but I'm not going to be able to respond. So I wanted to sort of widen the lens to imply that a focus on discretion alone is not going to get you better policy. Discretion in the context of a generous, a properly structured set of alternatives is a good idea. And I would trust that workers would be able to use that effectively. But don't make the mistake, is what I'm saying, of saying, well, we'll widen the discretion when the resources available to the clients are not any broader.
Thanks.
And your name is?
Greg Marsden from
yes.
Australia. I was thinking, when you talked about helping resources affecting the quality of decisions, in your conception of street-level bureaucrats, particularly in the context of welfare-to-work policies, what do you think is the place of social norms, you know, the sense in which the work ethic, for instance, in the case of welfare-to-work, is instructive about the reason that people do what they do?
Yeah.
And then how that translates into organisational norms. So it's a question about that place, I think. Of
yeah. Norms. Well, I'm sure you probably have much more to say about it than I do. But I think that I've spent a lot of time in recent years understanding how people think from the framing perspective. And one of the insights of framing research is that people have access to more than one thought structure. The same person may feel entitled, but also may feel responsible. It's a complexity of the human mind that's a reality that we ought to work with. So one doesn't need to change people from one to the other. One needs to create an environment in which one accesses a certain perspective, say a norm that one should work, and essentially deflect a norm that is not as that doesn't work as well for you. Am I responding to what you're suggesting? So I think leadership and expectations, there are ways of telling people that they must work which are demeaning and wrong from my point of view. And there are ways to encourage people to work which respect them and support them and if one can support them, I think can be very constructive. So this, you know, the simplistic notion that liberals are for one thing and conservatives for another, I think misses the opportunity to use public policy to shape people in better ways. But let's talk about this at greater length some other time.
I know we're all really grateful to Professor Lipsky for getting our day kicked off in such a thought-provoking way. I'm Jennifer Mosley. I'm on the faculty here at SSA, and I'm very pleased to present our first panel for the day. It's entitled Organizing for Work, Lessons from the U.S. Research. And we are glad to have four presenters that are each going to present findings from their research on how welfare policy is carried out at the ground level. So it's a nice follow-up to Dr. Lipsky's talk. We also have a discussant, and we only have an hour and a half for everyone, so I think we should go ahead and get started. I don't want to take up anyone's time. So I believe that our first presenter here today is Evelyn Brodkin herself, who I think needs no further introduction. So please welcome her.
It's a little daunting to follow Michael Lipsky, who will once and always be my mentor, and particularly when I think I'm going to say some things that he might possibly find disagreeable, but here we go. As we've said, in recent years, the U.S. welfare state has been undergoing a transformation. Key shifts involve deregulation of economic institutions and a growing regulation of disadvantaged individuals, at least in the sense that social benefits have been made increasingly contingent on work. I'd like to suggest that we see these shifts in social policy as part of a state effort to manage work, more specifically, to manage the work behavior of poor and disadvantaged adults. Okay. What's the project of managing work? The project of managing work has advanced in part through the policy shifts involving welfare and workfare, and in other policy areas as well, where work-based benefits are becoming increasingly part of what remains of the safety net. There is a second dimension of managing work, which involves managing the work behaviors of the street-level organizations that do the task of implementation. In this case, managing work occurs through deployment of governance mechanisms that we've talked about that shape how organizations make what I call, borrowing from my friend Robert Gooden, the real world of workfare in everyday life. Today, I want to share some key findings from my research examining how this project of managing work is taking place, not only in formal policy, but in the practices of street-level organizations. These organizations are a critical part of this project because, as Michael has discussed, it's through their informal practices that they create what comes to be the workfare experience. I think most of you are familiar with the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families program. I forgot I was so fancy and these things come up one at a time. And this was put into place passed in 1996, put into place in 1997. It made benefits, social assistance, conditional on participating in various kinds of work effort, which could include education and training, unpaid work, paid work, and so forth. It also provided some money for supportive services on the opportunity side. Most important, the hard edge of this, a 60-month lifetime limit on benefits to poor families, whether all at once or in parts. And remarkably, the law, as amended, does not have any provision for changing those rules under terms of economic collapse. or less. As we've discussed, it's important to recognize that formal welfare law is important, but never definitive. It is, like many other kinds of law, the product of legislative bargaining and negotiation, embracing multiple, sometimes contradictory objectives. For example, respond to individual needs and capacities, provide supportive services on the one hand, and on the other, enforce work and subject claimants to a variety of procedural tests, including participation in child support enforcement, attendance at a variety of meetings, and most importantly, producing stacks of documents to prove almost anything and everything. Oops. Does it have to be this complicated? It seems too complicated to get my PowerPoint right, but this mix of policy complexity and delegated discretion means that street-level organizations have a major, if often unacknowledged, role in shaping policy on the ground. To the extent that the project of managing work depends on delegation and discretion, it creates a new problem, namely, how to manage the work of policy implementation in a complex and discretionary policy environment. And the field of implementation research is replete with a history of all the strange and mysterious things that seem to happen when often idealized policy reforms encounter street-level organizations that live in a world not of ideals, but of gritty organizational realities, which I think Michael has alluded to. This managerial problem has been largely addressed through the deployment of governance mechanisms that aim to indirectly influence the work practices of street-level organizations. One tool of governance that's become quite ubiquitous is performance measurement, and in TANF, it's used to selectively monitor specific outcomes or outputs and link them to fiscal incentives. Two things critical to note here. First, I'm going to say it again, what's measured is selective, a matter I will take up later. Second, this type of management strategy markedly avoids attention to how performance is advanced in practice. In fact, the metaphor of steering, not rowing, makes clear where we're talking about getting, pointing to direction, but leaving the how outside of that mandate. But as I'll argue, how street-level organizations put policy into practice is the central question for understanding how the real world of workfare emerges. What is the real world of workfare? Like the view from your car's side mirror, things may not always be as they appear. What were the performance measures in TANF that are relevant to this discussion? First, performance requirements. Mistrusting states to be tough enough on work, Congress set quotas for placing claimants into various forms of work participation, specifying the menu of acceptable activities, and establishing an escalating proportion of recipients who must participate. Again, when the amendments to this law were enacted in 2005, they upped the ante. Second, caseload reduction credits, which rewarded states for reducing their caseloads almost no matter how they do it. They weren't allowed to do it by explicit policy. They were only rewarded if they did it either as they were supposed to, by making people better off, or in invisible ways you can't see, by making it very difficult to get and retain benefits. The caseload reduction credits and the performance measures don't allow you to see which thing happened. What didn't matter? The law did not hold states accountable for providing the right services to the right people, for the quality of assessments or services provided, or for improving the lives of poor families receiving welfare where their lifetime clock was ticking, counting off their months of remaining eligibility. The law did not hold states accountable for assuring access to eligible families. It did not monitor or hold states accountable for exclusionary practices. If performance measures could be perfectly designed, I'm not sure they can be. If they could be, one might expect them to be quite effective in marshaling discretion toward policy aims other things being equal, which they aren't necessarily. But when they're imperfect, capturing only some aspects of performance and leaving others invisible, they can influence discretion in unmonitored and potentially perverse or dangerous ways. I will argue that these governance features introduced a selective and unbalanced approach to accountability in an environment where there was already an increased scope for discretion. They emphasized accountability for work enforcement and caseload clearance, but not for the quality of service or assuring access to benefits. It is in this context, with its resource limitations, that street-level organizations have gone about the business of managing work, and in which what I'm calling the real world of workfare has developed. Under these circumstances, I suggest the interesting analytic question becomes not what works, but how does it work? How is policy produced in organizational practice, and what are these practices? How do they make this real world of research? In my studies, I've used a combination of methods, some of you will be shocked to know, including quantitative modeling of nationally representative survey data with my co-author, needless to say, Malay Majumdar, as well as what I call deep dish organizational ethnographies in welfare offices and welfare to work programs across Chicago. Through these methods, I've sought to make visible the invisible processes that come to constitute the policy experience. Ultimately, I argue that the real world of workfare isn't consistent with either the idealized policy rhetoric of welfare to work, nor with the idealized managerial rhetoric of performance and new public management. Rather, it is both more complicated and, in the end, has a harsher edge. And I will say, I'm not blaming the bureaucrats, my parenthetical. I'm not blaming the bureaucrats. I think they are responding to an environment shaped by resource constraints, governance methods, and a lack of a counterweight in terms of political feedback or from the polity, who's just largely in this country thrilled welfare caseloads are down. Don't look, don't ask, don't tell. And from claimants and their advocates who have limited tools for pushing systematically for things to be different. They win some wonderful cases in court, do some great advocacy on the ground, but the ability of the system to resist systematic change is still quite strong. Obviously, I can't present a full analysis today, but I want to highlight for you three patterns of organizational practice that I observed emerging in this environment that have important consequences for the real world of workfare. The three patterns, I didn't know I was this fancy. One, administrative practices that indirectly enforce work by creating barriers to accessing welfare benefits, irrespective of eligibility. If you can't get benefits, workers starve. Being a little extreme here. Second, programmatic practices that constitute the street-level experience fashioned under the rubric of governance arrangements, which I'll describe. And third, bureaucratic practices that effectively reconstitute citizenship by delegitimating claims for assistance from the state and blaming the poor for their poverty. Briefly, I've studied administrative exclusion in part with my colleague, Malay Majumdar, and studied how organizational practices may systematically discourage or deny access to assistance when they effectively raise the cost of claiming beyond the capacity of individuals to pay. So this is cost of claiming and exceeds ability to pay. And we have a study that is available online and hopefully soon in a journal, which demonstrates using nationally representative data that when procedural requirements are overly burdensome, confusing, or misapplied, administrative disorganization makes everything harder to do, and there is delay, unresponsiveness, and confusion. All of these kinds of things result in people being unable to access benefits or retain them. These exclusionary practices are neither monitored nor penalized by these unbalanced governance arrangements that emphasize and reward caseload reduction, even when achieved in this way. In fact, I should add, by preventing the acquisition of social assistance through these kinds of informal means, administrative exclusion also limits access to the supportive services that actually might have something beneficial to offer people who want to work and are trying to work. A second set of practices are the programmatic practices that are marked by classic street-level coping mechanisms of reductionism and ritualism. Shortest way to get the work done. Now, many of you here may have been in welfare offices in the U.S., others not. It's hard to describe. There's a lot of variation, but certainly the large urban welfare offices are difficult to describe and can be hard to believe. The hours of waiting in rows of plastic chairs in overheated buildings, the repeated requests for paperwork and documents that somehow disappear once submitted, the ritualized weekly job club lectures about how to smile, shake hands, show a good attitude to employers. I actually did participant observation in some of these, and I didn't do very well. It's a good thing I have a job. Now, I'm going to oversimplify some of these practices, but I'm doing it to draw a picture of how they operate in a context where you actually wind up with what's almost a prototypical street-level environment with mass processing caseloads and the burden of performance requirements and limited ways to help people, limited ways to really help people. So reductionism, it's by now well known. Street-level workers have discretion, even though supposedly operating under law and formal rules. That discretion is not unbounded, nor necessarily random in its effects, but shaped in part by incentives and disincentives, including those in performance that is measured both overall and penetrates into specific practice. In order to meet performance measures like getting enough of your caseload involved in work activities, or just reducing it. I witnessed practices like filling out assessment forms in advance of seeing the clients, referring people with mental health problems to services by their zip code, giving everyone the same appointment time and making them wait, regardless of the need to go pick up kids or go to doctor's appointments. Again, and I'm going to move really quickly, I'm going to take one last minute, rituals, job club sessions where I sat with women as they watched a film about how to get fancy vellum paper for their resumes and showing a white man in a nice suit applying for a job as a role model, whereas in the other part of the welfare office, an agency was interviewing people to lift boxes for a freight company. And they said, I don't care how big their earrings are or if they have tattoos all over their bodies. If they can get to the suburbs for the 4 a.m. shift, which they can't, we'll hire them. This disjuncture between the rituals of the welfare office and the realities of lower wage work are important. Finally, reconstituting citizenship, sometimes subtle. In this case, not so subtle, the welfare agency developed a formal model they trained people in called the pipeline, where clients were categorized as in lost, avoids contact with service providers, angry and resentful, stuck, follows only the letter of the plan, easily discouraged, or flowing, is on time for appointments and enthusiastically participates. In effect, clients who weren't doing well in a system where they did not necessarily have access to the help they needed were regarded as noncompliant, having a bad attitude, and not doing their part, and thus subject to sanctions. As the staffing instructor said, if you can't do anything, it means you're in a vegetative state. There are no medical exemptions. only personal barriers. The upshot of all this, which I, welfare roles are down. The question is how. The performance measures do not distinguish between reducing caseloads by making people better off or reducing caseloads through the kinds of practices that I'm describing. Less than half of potentially eligible families were receiving cash aid, and poverty in mother-only households is climbing. The street-level story is quite different from the popular story about welfare reform success. Something to consider. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Evelyn.